Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are joined by Michael Fitzpatrick, the Fitz in Fitz in the Tantrums, who's coming to the Anthem on February 14th. Michael, thanks so much for calling in.
Oh, please, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into the band itself, I want to know about you, how you started in music. I know you were born, I guess you were born in France, but when did you actually come over to L.A.? What age were you?
We moved to L.A. when I was about 5 years old.
Okay, cool. And how did you, tell me how you initially got bit by the music bug. You know, what records were laying around the house, or were you, you know, what did your parents play? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, I think for a lot of, like a lot of other musicians, you kind of just born with it in your bones. I mean, much to my parents' chagrin, I probably drove them absolutely nuts. But from the second I was born, I never stopped singing in the house, driving everyone crazy on road trips. But my parents are not musicians, but they are both music lovers. My dad is a crazy classical music and opera fanatic, but where he listens to it at like volume 11 in the house, blaring, making these very dramatic scenes of classical music. And then I had an older brother that turned me on to, you know, some awesome new wave music, some classic rock, you know, some hip hop. But, you know, I ended up going to a high school for the performing arts and was in a singing program there. So that's really where I kind of really dug into my love of music.
Awesome. And then I know, like, you know, simultaneously while you're exploring music, you also had an interest in experimental film, right? You studied that at the Cal Institute of the Arts. But tell me about that a little bit. What stuff is that? Is that like Louis Buñuel and like Maya Darren, or you know what were you into?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, growing up in LA, you kind of are forced to think maybe I want to be in the movie business. So I went to Cal Arts for filmmaking, not totally realizing that it was just like, it wasn't about Hollywood movie making. It was all very experimental filmmaking, like Stan Breckenridge and stuff like that. But you know what? It turned out to be an awesome learning experience for me, you know, and has helped for me really to inform, you know, basically, you know, all of our music videos, all of our visual presentation of the band. It's really helped me in being able to craft what we want the band to look like in our videos and all that kind of stuff. So,
and it also, of course, you know, obviously allowed you to meet your band member, James King. How did that meeting happen? You know, describe it for me. Was it in a hallway? Was it in the classroom? Was it on the quad? What was it?
Well, there's the subterranean level where they do all the filmmaking, and that's basically where all the trouble and all the mischievous behavior happens. So that's where we originally met. And he's such a phenomenal multi-instrumentalist. Obviously, first and foremost, plays every saxophone there is known to man. But such a talent. So when I was writing the first songs for Fits in the Tantrums, I knew I wanted the first record to really rely heavily on saxophone. And so I gave him a call, and we started working up those first songs together. And then we were like, this is just begging to be played out live, you know. And, you know, when you're in bands over the course of your life, it can be really hard to find the right pairing of people with the right amount of talent, like kind of similar style and also commitment. And this was one of those magic moments, as with so many parts of Fits in the Tantrums, which it was like 6 phone calls. We were in a room. We played one song. I walked out of the room and I called this little singer-songwriter club here in L.A. that's kind of well-known, called the Hotel Cafe. Booked us a show a week later, walked in and said, we got a show next week. Everyone's like, we've played one song. And I was like, it was just magic. I could tell it sounded like we've been playing together for years. We played that show a week later and kind of haven't stopped playing shows and touring since that day, and that's almost 11 years ago to the day.
Wow, that's insane. That just one song and you get a booking. how do you actually add Noelle Skaggs? Because of course she is, you know, such a signature part of your guys' sound, but how did that introduction happen?
Well, James actually is the one, because I said we need an amazing female vocalist to counter me on these songs. And he had ended. He had just done a hip hop tour with her. They were both hired guns on some big hip hop tour, and had made a connection. So she was the first person he said we should call, and it just all worked. You know, not you don't know if your voices are going to blend well together, and it just worked instantaneously. And then anybody that's seen us play live knows that. We really put on a super high energy show. We're never standing there like wallflowers. It's like full tilt the whole time. And Noelle and I just really sort of saw that the more energy that we gave to the audience and to each other, the more we just sort of made this pressure cooker experience where the energy just in the club just got crazier and crazier.
You guys really do. Is it true? I know you guys. You know, one of your first big tours was when you were touring with Maroon 5. Is it true about the story, the whole thing about his tattoo artist suggesting you guys to him while he was in there?
I know it all sounds like some made up fairy tale, but it really is. And that was the thing. You know, I think for all of us, we had been in so many bands before, all had struggled, busting our butts. And could never really catch a break. For me personally, that was like almost 10 years of like abject rejection, total rejection from the music industry, from just having to guilt trip 10 people to come to our show. And there was just this magic that was really in combination with all this hard work we were doing. And we had played like 6 shows. We had released a little EP by ourselves. Somehow this tattoo artist was visiting from New York, picked up our CD, took it back to New York. Adam Levine walks in and he says, Adam, you got to hear my new favorite band sits in the tantrums. He plays it. Adam freaks out. He starts tweeting about us. We start talking. A week later, we're performing in this little club here in LA that basically had couches all around the stage. And there was Adam Levine sitting 5 feet away from us. We performed. He gave us a high five and left. And then a day later, or 2 days later, we got the offer to open up for Maroon 5 on this huge college tour they were doing, which we were all losing our minds. Like, oh, my God, this is amazing. Until we realized, oh, this is going to cost us a lot of money to go out on tour and keep up with these big tour buses, you know. And so everybody just dug deep. We almost went broke as a band, and we just rallied, and I put all my savings into the band, and turned out to be one of the best decisions, because that was the first thing that took us from a local band or regional band to being on a national level, where we were just playing and people were early days of Facebook just saying, like, posting like, yo, I just saw this band. All my friends are coming to the Northeast soon. You got to go check them out. And it just spread like wildfire like that.
Freaking awesome, man. You mentioned that little, you know, that self-recorded EP you did. But then, of course, after that, you do your first official, you know, studio album, Picking Up the Pieces, 2010. When you look back at that, you know, what do you remember about that one in terms of either something, you know, you're very proud of as a, you know, your first official album, or are there certain things that you look back, you know, in the ins and outs where you're kind of like, we're still figuring things out a little bit there?
I mean, you know, I think we'll always be incredibly proud of that record. You know, we made that record in my living room for like $20, literally, you know, just with one crappy old mic that we were all like one by one layering and overdubbing onto the record. And we made this record. It was this old mic that was fitting into, especially when we were on that first record, really leaning into like this mixture of pop and 60s soul with some hip hop, like 90s influence in there mixed in. And, you know, that record, you know, is what put us on the map. So, you know, I can never listen to it in any other way but as the thing that made all of my dreams come true, you know?
Absolutely. But then it was more than just a dream. It's your second one. And I know that's when you guys really blew up and, you know, became a household name, you know, with the Walker. That thing was played all over the radio. How'd you come up with that little whistling, you know, a little ditty in the beginning? That's about as catchy of a earworm as it gets. So.
Yeah, well, I had, you know, I always, whenever I have 2 seconds free, I'm always trying to, like, start a little vibe, a little ditty. And I had gotten, God, I can't remember the name of this weird old vintage keyboard that had like a weird buzz to it, and it was so hard to record. I finally had to just literally put a microphone in front of its little built-in speaker. And I played this little keyboard line, had a little beat going, and then I just started whistling. And I went, and I was like, wait, that's like annoyingly catchy. And so I recorded like 10 of me doing it. And that was actually before we had any lyrics, any melody. There was this little keyboard part, a beat, and this whistle. And I was just, I knew that that whistling was going to be a thing that was going to annoy the crap out of everybody, but get stuck in their head. And so then we just tried to build a song around that. And, yeah, that turned out to be our second number one at alternative radio after we had done Out of My League. You know, it was the song that, like, kind of really went to a whole nother level.
Absolutely. And so the Walker has that catchy whistle, but then, of course, the next big one, Hand Clap, you do it with a hand clap. There's a clapping hand. You know, you're so good at taking just a simple thing, just burying it in our ears. My listeners are going to kill me if you don't give me a little bit of a tidbit of how Hand Clap came together, man. How do you remember, you know, how you thought or any could in the studio recording
exactly.
That?
I remember exactly, you know, because to me, you know, I think one of the biggest mistakes artists make is they write a song and they think it's awesome. And I don't know if it's just I'm incredibly hard on myself or I have a massive fear of failure, but I have always tried to write as many songs as possible. And, you know, when we wrote the More Than Just a Dream album, we had been coming off of the Picking Up the Pieces success. We got off the road after touring for 2 years. We sat down, we wrote 40 songs in 30 days. Boom, there was Out of My League. There was The Walker. Get off another 2+ years of touring that record and think, oh, it's going to be the same thing. And especially because we always want the records to evolve, didn't know exactly what we wanted the third record to sound like. And those first 6 months were incredibly difficult. There was nothing that we were writing that was inspiring me. Everything I felt like was just not working. And I finally walked into my friend's studio, Sam Hollander, and I was just super frustrated. And I just said, oh, you know what? Tired of letting my brain get in the way. Just give me like the cheesiest horn sample you can give me. I was like, all right, now give me a crappy old drum beat. And I built a little drum beat and I played this little bass line and I started playing. And I was like, okay. And then Sam and I just looked at each other. And we just wrote that song in 15 minutes from start to finish. And about 7 minutes into writing it, I knew that this was going to be the biggest song that we've ever had. And I laid down the vocals, my scratch track, and that scratch track of vocals is the version that's on the record that people have heard a gazillion times now. I tried 5 times to recreate it with a fancy, expensive mic in a fancy studio. I could never capture the same energy because I think there was so much elation and relief in knowing that I had the song that I could never capture that same energy back.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you're right. You were right. You said 7 seconds in, you knew, and you were absolutely right. All right, well, bringing it sort of all the present, you know, with all the feels, your fourth and latest album, at that point, you know, you're not some struggling musician anymore. Now you're massive and, you know, everybody knows you around the world. So was it harder putting that one together, or is it just kind of you can just sit back and relax a little bit and know that you can just let your creative juices flow at that point?
No, you can never relax. I think, you know, especially the bigger song you have, the more of this, like, albatross, this monkey on your back you have, where then everybody at your label, everybody on your team, everyone is like, I don't know, is it hand clap though? I'm like, well, we didn't write hand clap to be hand clap, you know? So at a certain point, I just had to let all those expectations go and just make a record that we were proud of, that to me, honestly, I'm more proud of this record than anyone before, put so much heart into it. You know, I feel like there's so many important messages from dealing with stress and anxiety and depression to wanting to feel more connected to your friends and your family and your loved one in this digital age where we're all staring at our phones 24/7. Just really tried to put it all into a record that, to me, I couldn't be more proud of. You know, the title song from the whole album, All the Feels, you know, it's amazing, you know, playing it out every night and seeing people connect with it. You know, we have a song on the radio now called I Just Want to Shine, which to me, that song's really about just dealing with stress and anxiety and your demons and overcoming them, you know, and just wanting to put out these positive messages also while acknowledging that we're all human and there's a struggle for all of us every day, you know, to try and keep your head above water. And so to see the reaction from our fans, we've been touring it for like 9 months now. It's been so exciting to do it. And, you know, to me, I couldn't wait to get back to DC and play at the Anthem, you know, it'll be our first time there.
Oh yeah. Have you heard Big Things? It's a pretty cool spot. I was there when the Foo Fighters opened. They were the kickoff show a couple years ago. What have you heard? I want to hear what Fits in the Tantrums has heard about the Anthem.
I mean, you know, DC has been such an amazing supporter of this band since day one. You know, we've done so many nights at the 930 Club. We've sold it out every single time. We're going to sell out this one again. I think there's a couple tickets left. You know, DC has just always been amazing. I know it's the same family as 930. So, you know, I'm just excited. I'm excited to come back and to play one more time for DC.
And I think it's a Valentine's Day show too, right? Does that have any impact on the show? Special plan with that, or just keeping your head down, playing the normal tunes?
Oh yeah, I mean we might need to break out one of our reach deep into one of the sad breakup songs from album one.
All right. Well, our fans will have to see. In closing, just sort of on like a little human note, I know you're a dad three times over now. Congrats. How does that change your life or even affected your music maybe?
I mean, it's, you know, the most radical thing from being like an autonomous being to all of a sudden being responsible for another human being. But, you know, for me, meeting my wife and us having kids, you know, was like at 5 years into this band, you know, with every dream coming true. You know, we were riding, ascending to a whole nother level with Out of My League and The Walker, and yet I was in one of the darkest places I had ever been, because I think I had put all of my energy into reaching my goal, and then you reach your goal and you sometimes realize it doesn't do what you think it's going to do, and at the end of the day you can't hold your career and your success and spoon it at night, you know? And I was feeling very detached from my world, from my friends, from my family, just because you're a traveling nomad. You're in a different city every day. It's a very bizarre lifestyle. So for me to meet my wife, Kaylee, and have our kids and start a family, just it really saved me and grounded me and gave me more of a purpose than ever. Now it's harder with my kids older. You know I'm leaving. They get really bummed out when I'm leaving, but try and bring them out on tour as many times as I can. We get our own tour bus and we're a traveling rock and roll family. So it's got its highs and its lows, but you know, to me, it's meant everything and given me a whole new purpose for keeping going, you know.
Awesome. Well, I'm so happy to hear that. So congrats again. And congrats on all the continued success.
Thank you,
can't wait to see you at the Anthem. Again, everybody, it's Fitz and the Tan, February 15th at the Anthem here in D.C. Michael Fitzpatrick, you've been generous with your time. Thanks so much for calling in. We appreciate it.
Thanks, brother. I'll see you guys soon.